My name is John Schramm, and the title of our session is Thomas Merton. I've added one word, Thomas Merton, contemplative monk, his life and writings. This is my sixth summer at Holden, and so I'm used to being opposite something else at the same hour, but to be opposite conception fertilization with pictures.
Pretty tough competition.
Why are you here? Thomas Merton, contemplative monk and celibate. Does that... Anybody want to go next door? Why would I take the time of people at Holden Village for an hour on the life and writings of a Roman Catholic monk who spent half of his 53 years cloistered in Gethsemane Abbey, Kentucky, from a tradition that is not mine, who's now been dead 15 years? Why would I think that he is the kind of person that I should introduce you to? I think because he had the amazing capacity to bring together, in a way that most people cannot bring together, a deep-rooted spirituality and also a way of looking without illusion at the world around him. The title of one of his books, Contemplation in a World of Action, even puts those two things together. Is it not true that most of the time, if you go to a church convention, there will be those who are the activists, and they bring the motions about nuclear arms race and world hunger, and other people are interested in prayer and liturgical renewal and the life of meditation and spirituality. Merton brought together those in one life in a very beautiful way, and I think he is worth learning to know. First of all, his life, and it's probably the least important of what we do, but we'll spend a few minutes on it so you have some idea who Thomas Merton was. Born January 31st, 1915, his father was a painter, a good enough painter that he could earn his living and travel around the world doing it. He never became famous, but he was an accomplished artist. So Thomas Merton's early boyhood was unsettled, literally. He lived a lot of different places in the first 16 years of his life. His father was a New Zealander by birth, his mother from Ohio. He was born in France, came to the United States when he was a year old, but was born overseas. Not a religious family at all. His father seldom went to any church, his mother occasionally to a Quaker meeting. His mother died when he was six, and so his early boyhood was being raised by grandparents who were remarkably loving people and for whom he had a great fondness, but again, it made for a kind of unsettled early boyhood. Thomas Merton did write an autobiography, Seven Story Mountain. I will read from it tonight, and I will also make some recommendations during the evening. I recommend that you not start with this one. If you have never read any Thomas Merton, do not start with this one. If you learn to love Merton and then want to go back and read his autobiography after you've read some other things, I think you will enjoy. Why not start with this one? Did you ever spend considerable time with someone who had just been converted to anything? A new convert with the answer. Great, great time with them, right? Thomas Merton has just found the church, and it's more triumphant and arrogant in some ways than anything else he wrote. He is much more open to other people's ideas and much more exciting when he writes later. But there are some very beautiful sections in here. Let me share one of my favorites. He's a young boy being raised by grandparents with his young brother, John Paul, in Douglaston, Long Island. Is Lou here? Smith? All right. The context is the East Coast, which Lou Smith loves so much. I suppose it is usual for elder brothers, when they are still children, to feel themselves demeaned by the company of a brother 4 or 5 years younger, whom they regard as a baby and whom they tend to patronize and look down upon. So when Russ and I and Bill made our huts in the woods out of boards and tar paper, which we collected around the foundations of the many cheap houses which the speculators were now putting up as fast as they could all over Douglaston, we severely prohibited John Paul and Russ's little brother Tommy and their friends from coming anywhere near us. If they did try to come and get into our hut, or even to look at it, we would chase them away with stones. When I think now of that part of my childhood, the picture I get of my brother John Paul is this. Standing in a field about 100 yards away from a clump of sumacs where we've built our hut is this little perplexed 5-year-old kid in short pants and a kind of leather jacket, standing quite still, his arms hanging down at his sides, gazing in our direction, afraid to come any nearer on account of the stones. As insulted as he is saddened, his eyes full of indignation and sorrow, yet he does not go away. We shout at him to get out of there, beat it, go home. We wing a couple more rocks in that direction. He does not go away. We tell him to play some other place. He does not move. There he stands, not sobbing, not crying, but angry and unhappy and offended and tremendously sad. Yet he's fascinated by what we're doing, nailing shingles all over the new hut, and his tremendous desire to be with us and to do what we're doing will not permit him to go away. The law written in his nature says that he must be with his elder brother and do what he's doing. He cannot understand why this law of love is being so wildly and unjustly violated in his case. There was a time when I and my magnificent friends in our great hut, having formed a gang, thought we were sufficiently powerful to antagonize the extremely tough Polish kids who had a real gang over in Little Neck, a mile away. We used to go over in their neighborhood. We would stand facing in the general direction of the billboards behind which they had their headquarters, and from a very safe distance we would shout defiance and challenge them to come out and fight. Nobody came out. Perhaps it's because we went when no one was at home. But then one cold and rainy afternoon we observed that numbers of large and small figures varying in age from 10 to 16, and most of them very brawny with caps pulled down over their eyes in a businesslike way, were filtering in by the various streets, gathering in the vacant lot outside our house. There they stood, their hands in their pockets. They did not make any noise or yell or shout any challenges. They just stood looking at the house. There were 20 or 25 of them. There were 4 of us. The climax of this situation came when Frieda, our German maid, told us that she was very busy with house cleaning and that we must all get out of the house immediately. Without listening to our extremely nervous protest, she chased us out of the house the back way. We made a dash through several backyards, went down the other block, ended up safely in the house where Bill lived, which was at the other end of the vacant lot, from which we viewed the silent and pugnacious group from Little Neck, still standing around with the evident determination of staying there for quite a while. Then an extraordinary thing happened. The front door of our house at the other end of the lot opened, and my little brother, John Paul, came walking down the steps with a certain amount of dignity and calmness. He crossed the street. He started into the lot. He walked toward the Little Neck gang. They all turned toward him. He kept walking. He walked right through the middle of them. One or two of them took their hands out of their pockets. John Paul just looked. He turned his head on one side, then on the other. He walked right through the middle of them. Nobody even touched him, and he came to the house where we were. We did not chase him away. Merton's father took Merton with him after several years and put him in school in France. Merton, if you read Seven Story Mountain or anything else, had the beginnings of his trouble with teeth, and he had teeth troubles all of his life. So part of his autobiography is the trips to the dentist and some other medical problems which he had. His father then put him in school in England at Ockham. All this time, the tremendous amount of not only his interest in, but of the assigned reading in English Lit gives you some reason why later he's so well informed of Greek mythology and all kinds of literature. I as I read his autobiography and thought of the really very few things I was asked to read in a high school in the United States. The education is just so different, but he had a great fascination and interest in this. When he was 16, his father died. Now he's alone in the world, except for his brother John Paul, and there's really only one option, that's go back to Long Island again. And until college then, he's again raised by those grandparents. He went to Columbia University, fair student, certainly good at the things he liked to do, editor not of the sophisticated paper, but of the humor magazine, and cartoonist, and some of the cartoons were raunchy. Some of the jokes were anything but what a Cistercian monk would keep in a scrapbook to show Father Abbott when he got to Gethsemane Abbey. Some of the sketches were nudes dancing. There are books with many of these scraps of his artwork and his humor. He described these years as saying, "I was a very worldly man." Well, he drank beer with the boys, and according to a new biography by, I think it's Monica Furlong, he may have fathered a child in these years. That's fairly new. They're doing so much Merton research that I kind of tire of all of the books about Thomas Merton. But suffice it to say, he was not living like a novice monk while he was at Columbia University. All right. His conversion was very undramatic. I think that's the best way I can put it. As you read through Seven Story Mountain, you're aware that there is a hunger, a spiritual hunger, but he visited churches once in a while. You can check me on it. I think he went to a Lutheran church once. I don't know what that says about the Lutheran church or our liturgy or the preacher he heard, but he never went back. There was a fascination with Roman Catholicism, even though that was not his background from either his mother or father's side. And there was more and more reading in Thomas Aquinas and in other Roman Catholic literature. But basically, when I say undramatic, he decided one day, "I'm going to be a Christian." And he went to Corpus Christi Church near Columbia University. He went to a side door because the front door was locked. There was a bell. He pushed the bell. One of the parish priests came and he said, "Father, I wish to be baptized." There was a little bit of private instruction. He took two student friends with him, one a Jewish lifelong friend, to witness the baptism. He was baptized, and that was it. It was not a bolt of lightning or anything else. But once he was baptized, Merton was the kind of person who then felt that his life now should be shaped by Jesus Christ. And he tried to find the best way, find his vocation as one who had been baptized into the name of Jesus. So he tried all kinds of things. Catholic worker movement, worked among the poor, worked in soup kitchens, visited monasteries, sought and at least thought of a religious vocation of priest. Always was fascinated, as Dan Erlander is, by St. Francis, so he went to a Franciscan monastery. He found that even though they wore robes and sandals, they, as an order, were very wealthy. He was kind of disillusioned by the Franciscan monastery. He didn't think it was consistent with St. Francis. Taught at City College of New York. Editor or a writer for a newspaper, always skilled at writing. If you know of his writings regarding faith and violence and the war, you would assume that at the time which he was of draft age, that he might have been a conscientious objector. That was not the case. That came later. Came so strongly that when he wrote, some of the things were an embarrassment to the monastery, and he had to write with a pseudonym when he was critical of the United States position in Vietnam. But at that time, he went down to volunteer for the army. He was rejected. Why? Bad teeth. He thought maybe he would feel more that he had a vocation if he taught in a church university rather than City College in New York, so he taught at St. Bonaventure. That was more fulfilling, but still there was a kind of desire to be more fully in a vocation of serving Christ. One of the great influences was a teacher at Columbia, Mark Van Doren. Thomas Merton said of Mark Van Doren, "When you had him for a class, you found out who you were." that's the highest compliment you can give to a teacher, right? You don't find out that much about the teacher, but you find out who you were. So he continued friendship with him on some of the writing he was doing. But then he made a visit to Gethsemane Abbey, and probably the most strict Cistercian Trappist monks, the order in the United States anyway, that would be the most rigorous in simplicity of lifestyle and in rigorous daily schedule. I went on retreat at a Cistercian Trappist monastery, and the day starts at 3 a.m. with the first hour of service. And to show you what I mean by strict, the Father Abbot, who was the one person in the whole place allowed to talk to us so that we had at least one visitor, all the rest maintain a vow of silence, said, well, that early morning hour at 3 o'clock, we made a change. We don't make many changes. We made a change 10 years ago, and we allow one small cup of coffee at 2:45. It helped the singing immeasurably. That's strict, right? I mean, one change in 10 years, and it's to allow a little coffee. They should come to Holden and know where that abuse can go, finally, right? As you read, and of course he's writing later as he writes back, you kind of know that that's the call upon his life. So at age 26, he applies and is accepted to be a novice at Gethsemane Abbey. As it works out, that's exactly the halfway point in his life. He lived to be 52 and a half years old. So the first half of his life is now over, and the next half of his life is Gethsemane Abbey, and part of that life, a hermitage even separate from the very simple monastery at Gethsemane Abbey, where he finally finds that kind of solitary life which was the vocation upon his life. So he does several things. He gave his clothes to the people in Harlem at a food and clothing place where he had worked for the Catholic Worker. He sent his books to the Franciscans. He sent a manuscript of a couple things to Mark Van Doren. He tore up two novels, and he got his possessions down to one duffel bag, like you take to the gym for volleyball. And he even had a knock at the door. There's no way to get from the railroad to Gethsemane Abbey, and so he got there about 3 a.m. But they opened the door, and the rest of his life was cloistered. They pushed him to write too much. So I've given you one piece of advice so far. Don't start with Seven Story Mountain. The second piece of advice is don't read everything written by Thomas Merton. This book by John Higgins, S.J., has a bibliography at the back, and it starts with 66 full-size books. Then it has in articles and journals and other things 19 pages of small print, all of which he wrote. It's just amazing what he did in 26 years. For instance, this is a journal, fairly good size because this is small print. There is material for 20 journals this size, unpublished. Just an amazing amount of writing. He also was novice master for a long time, and that would be to give the instruction to those people who were coming and considering coming into the monastery. So you can get to know him now in two ways. You can listen to the tapes of some of the talks he gave to novices. They're fairly expensive, which I think would alarm Thomas Merton. The New Directions Publishing Company is strict on copyright, and the books are expensive, and the tapes are out of sight. But the other way that most of us do it is many, many things that have been written and published. So the major thing I want to do tonight, in about 20 minutes before we get to what I think are the two major contributions of Merton, is just share some of those that I think are some of the better things that he wrote, and to give you some suggestions on where to start. If you like journal format, then start with Conjectures of a Guilty Bystander. If you like Markings' Dag Hammarskjöld, or if you have trouble with Reinhold Niebuhr's stuff, find Leaves from the Notebook of a Tamed Cynic when he was a parish pastor in Detroit, and you'll find a very human person talking about the trials and tribulations of a young pastor in the midst of the Depression in Detroit. If you like that kind of thing, you would learn to know Thomas Merton in his essentially diary or journal. You will find some humor. Let me share with you the kind of thing I mean. Have any of you ever eaten at a monastery where they keep silence? Any ever had a meal at a monastery where they keep silence? Okay, Verlon has. If you didn't know it, they do have, partly to take care of any possible awkwardness, they do have a reader. And the reader is given a book by Father Abbott. And so I went once a week to a Benedictine monastery for 2 years plus. And so I got used to sometimes the books were very boring. Other times I got interested. The point is, if you don't want to listen, it's okay. But if you really are not into something in your own head, it gives you something to do while you eat, because otherwise the room is very quiet. So Merton is talking about the reading that's going on at the present time in his monastery. The reader in the refectory this week, a particularly serious monk, announces at each meal the title of the book he's been given to read, A Right to be Merry. He drops his voice every time he reads the word Merry, as if he hesitates to utter it, almost as if he would question the title altogether and would rather say, God forbid, not a right to be merry. And if anything in the book concerns eating or drinking, he dims his voice ever so slightly with the same type of concern, as if withdrawing his will out from under the word eat, he lets it float on its own irresponsibly before the face of a divine reproof. But when he gets to words like death and dead, he lays them down squarely in the middle of the refectory with satisfaction and with utter finality. Okay. In other words, he's the kind who could come to a place and help people laugh at themselves. So part of what he does is to say some of the monks are overly serious. In fact, Merton says of some theologians that they don't seem to be happy unless God is a problem. You will also find, I lived in the middle of Washington, D.C., had the Washington Post on our front door every day during the times Merton writes of the civil rights movement and of the Vietnam years. And I really can say that Merton saw more clearly from a monastery in Kentucky what was going on than I did. In other words, if you think of monk retreat from the issues, I hope this shatters your stereotype of what a monk is. He writes about the issues of the day with clarity. When I get to the two contributions, which is the reason for contemplative monk, Merton gave me a different idea of contemplation. It was not to see some different world. It was to see this world differently. And I think you really sense that when Merton takes an issue and speaks to it. What else might you start with? Thoughts in solitude. Probably the what's the word? Least complicated, simple, devotional kind of material that I hope is part of your expectation of what a monk would write. There is a prayer very similar to the Holden prayer. I think it's a beautiful kind of thing for Holden staff who know at most whether they're going to turn right or left in Wenatchee when they leave here. Almost no one knows what they're going to go to next after they've been on Holden staff. So this is another Holden prayer. My Lord God, I have no idea where I'm going. I do not see the road ahead of me. I cannot know for certain where it will end, nor do I really know myself, and the fact that I think I'm following your will does not mean that I'm actually doing so. But I believe that the desire to please you does in fact please you, and I hope I have that desire in all that I'm doing. I hope that I will never do anything apart from that desire, and I know that if I do this, you will lead me by the right road, though I may know nothing about it. Therefore, I will trust you always, though I may seem to be lost and in the shadow of death. I will not fear, for you are ever with me, and you will never leave me to face my perils alone. Also in Thoughts in Solitude, he has the way in which you know that you are in your vocation. It's when you stop thinking about life and living and begin living. And if that vocation is to be a solitary, as it was for Merton, you will never be satisfied until you are in that. If your vocation is to be active and in community or married or whatever else is your calling, you will not be satisfied until that vocation has come forth. So Merton does not see his vocation as everyone's vocation, but the fact of being called to something and being restless until you have found that place is one of Merton's contributions. A little more difficult, a little more abstract than Thoughts in Solitude, but one that I think someday will be a classic of devotional contemplative literature, whether it'll ever rank with Cloud of Unknowing and some of the St. John of the Cross material, I don't know, but probably of all the things that Merton wrote, this one may go down as the classic, New Seeds of Contemplation. I'm not going to read some of the more difficult. I'm going to read some of what I think are the more delightful sections of it. One of my favorites, if someone would say, what would be the first quality you need if you're going to be a contemplative? I don't know what you'd answer, but Merton's is one of the first things to learn if you want to be a contemplative is how to mind your own business. Not a bad start. Maybe especially for members of the church, right? Now I'm meddling. How about this one, if it hits you? Fickleness and indecision are really basically signs of self-love. If you can never make up your mind what the will of God is for you, if you're always veering from one opinion to another and from one practice to another, from one method to another, it may be an indication that you're trying to get around God's will and to do your own will with a quiet conscience. As soon as God has you in one church, you'd rather be in another one. As soon as you taste one way of prayer, you want to try another. You're always making resolutions, but you're always breaking them with counter-resolutions. You ask your confessor, but you do not remember the answer. Before you finish one book, you begin another. Oof. And with every book you read, you change the whole plan of your interior life. One of the first chapters in the book New Seeds of Contemplation is what contemplation is not. The only way to get rid of misconception about contemplation is to experience it. Contemplation cannot be taught. It cannot even be clearly explained. It can only be hinted at, suggested, pointed to, and symbolized. Contemplation is not prayerfulness or a tendency to find peace and satisfaction in liturgical rites. Contemplation is not psychic peace. A contemplative is not one who likes to sit and think, still less one who sits with a vacant stare. Contemplation is much more than thoughtfulness or a taste for reflection. Contemplation is not a trance or ecstasy, nor the hearing of sudden, unutterable words, nor the imagination of lights. It's like the poster we once had in our house. God is not a giant bear aspirin. If you think that what Merton does is to, in essence, find a way in which you kind of conk out of reality and sit with eyeballs rolled up in constant religious ecstasy, you will have a great shock. Let no one hope to find in contemplation an escape from conflict, from anguish, or from doubt. New Seeds of Contemplation, some very, very fine things. I'm going to use this. Another way to read Thomas Merton is to get an anthology so you don't have to buy 50 books. This is probably the best. A Thomas Merton reader, Thomas McConnell. I have a hardbound, but there is a paperback for $4.95. We don't have it anymore, do we, Mary? It never did have. Well, I saw it in a bookstore in Kalamazoo, Michigan, if you need to. All right. I'm going to read one quote from this, and it isn't, certainly is not the most profound thing in the book. I just love it. A bad book about the love of God is a bad book. Even though it's about the love of God. There are many who think that because they've written about God, they have automatically written a good book. To be a monk is, first of all, to tell the truth. right? I'm going to give you another, a different Thomas Merton, consistent with what I've said, but it really wouldn't be fair unless I read you some of the kinds of things that telling the truth as he saw it meant, and some of the kinds of things that to be a monk is to stand counter-culture to the prevailing values of the world around you, and sometimes that means to write what other people would call most charitably criticism and most viciously treason. This is a letter to Pablo Antonio Quadro concerning the giants. Thomas Merton is writing to a poet friend in some Latin American or South American country, and he in essence is using biblical imagery of the giants, and it's clear that it's USSR and the United States, and one is Gog and one is Magog. And lest you think he's kind of pro-communist, he's not at all. He is very grateful that he lives in the giant he lives in, because in the other giant he'd have been squashed long ago, and this giant gives him all kinds of freedom, for which he's extremely happy. Doesn't have any naivete about what it would be like to live in the other giant. But he does think the two giants are out to destroy one another. He writes this in 1961. And what he's really saying, and sometimes you don't know whether you think, well, the monk is just kind of naively nonchalant, or whether we all are really to have a kind of God-given nonchalance that can say to a friend, when you, the southern hemisphere and the little countries that are not in the nuclear arms race, when you inherit this world and what's left of it, don't make all the mistakes that the giants made. That's really what this letter is, just beautifully written. I have to read a couple things so that you get the idea of it, and then all I'm really going to read in totality is the last paragraph. It is certainly true that the storm of history has now arisen out of our own hearts, and it has sprung unbidden out of the emptiness of technological man. It is the genie he has summoned out of the depths of his own confusion, this complacent sorcerer's apprentice who spends billions on weapons of destruction and space rockets and cannot provide decent meals, shelter, and clothing for two-thirds of the human race. I no longer have any desire to be considered enlightened by the standards of stool pigeons and torturers, whose most signal claim to success is that they have built so many extermination camps and have operated them to the limit of their capacity. We must be wary of ourselves when the worst that is in man becomes objectified in society, approved, acclaimed, and deified. When hatred becomes patriotism and murder a holy duty. When spying and delation are called love of truth and a stool pigeon is a public benefactor. When the gnawing and prurient resentments of frustrated bureaucrats become the conscience of the people and a gangster is enthroned in power. Then we must fear the voice of our own heart, even when it denounces them. For are we not all tainted with the same poison? I have learned that an age in which politicians talk about peace is an age in which everybody expects war. The great man of the earth, he had no inclusive language whatsoever. It just, I'm not going to change him tonight. He would, I think he would be open to the forums at Holden, but he didn't do well. That the great men of the earth would not talk of peace so much if they did not secretly believe it possible with just one more war to annihilate their enemies forever. Always, after just one more war, it will dawn, the new era of love. But first, everybody who is hated must be eliminated. For hate, you see, is the mother of their kind of love. Now I'm going to read the last part. You got some idea of what he's talking about. 1961. Got the date? I hear they're working on a bomb that will destroy nothing but life. Men, animals, birds, perhaps also vegetation. But it will leave buildings, factories, railways, natural resources. Only one further step and the weapon will be one of absolute perfection. It should destroy books, works of art, musical instruments, toys, tools, and gardens, but not destroy flags, weapons, gallows, electric chairs, gas chambers, instruments of torture, or straitjackets in case someone should accidentally survive. That's emblems of a season of fury. I'm not sure it's in print anymore. I'm going to give you one more like that and then relieve the level of Merton's writings. Some of them are, well, I sometimes get shook in the middle of them if I do just know what's happened before. I'm going to read one more like that and then get something more light. Just a minute. A devout meditation in memory of Adolf Eichmann. One of the most disturbing facts that came out in the Eichmann trial was that a psychiatrist examined him and pronounced him perfectly sane. I don't doubt it at all. That's what I find disturbing. If all of the Nazis had been psychotics, as some of their leaders probably were, their appalling cruelty would have been in some sense easier to understand. It is much worse to consider a calm, well-balanced, unperturbed official conscientiously going about his desk work, his administrative job, which happened to be the supervision of mass murder. He was thoughtful, orderly, unimaginative. He had a profound respect for system and for law and order. He was obedient, loyal, a faithful officer of a great state. He served his government well. He was not bothered by guilt. I've not heard that he developed any psychosomatic illnesses. Apparently, he slept well. He had a good appetite, or so it seems. The sanity of Eichmann is disturbing. We equate sanity with a sense of justice and humanness, with prudence, with the capacity to love and understand other people. We rely on the sane people of the world to preserve it from barbarism, madness, and destruction. Now it begins to dawn on us that it is precisely the sane ones who are the most dangerous. Eichmann was sane. I've jumped, but I don't think I've done any violence to the four pages. Eichmann was sane. Those who fought in World War II and the ones who carried out the total destruction of entire cities were sane. Those who have now invented and developed atomic bombs, thermonuclear bombs, and missiles, who have planned the strategy of the next war, who have evaluated various possibilities of using bacterial and chemical agents, they are not crazy people. They are sane. The ones who coolly estimate how many millions of victims can be considered expendable in a nuclear war do all right on Rorschach ink blots. On the other hand, you probably will find that the pacifists and the ban the bomb people are quite seriously, as we read in Time magazine, a little crazy. I'm beginning to realize that sanity is no longer a value or an end in itself. The sanity of modern man is about as useful to him as the huge bulk and muscles of a dinosaur. If he were a little less sane, if he were a little more doubtful, a little more aware of absurdities and contradictions, perhaps there might be a possibility of survival. But he is sane, too sane. Perhaps we must say that in a society like ours, the worst insanity is to be totally without anxiety, to be totally sane. That too is Thomas Merton. The one I just read is from Raids on the Unspeakable, and that's what I'd like to get to on a note that's much more fun. This is my favorite Merton book. I told you to start with Conjectures of a Guilty Bystander because this is not the easiest Thomas Merton, but do me the favor that if you really are going to read some Thomas Merton, either because of or in spite of my hour tonight, include this one in it. It's a marvelous book. I knew I was going to like it the minute I opened the prologue. Thomas Merton did talk to his books, if that bothers you. He's a little crazy. But he did talk to his books. Listen to this one. Well, Raids on the Unspeakable is the title. Well, Raids, you're grown up now. It's time for you to go out and meet people, as the other books have done. They usually have managed pretty well on their own. They were, for the most part, good-mannered. Some of them were even rather devout. As for you, Raids, you may need special advice. I must say you've proved yourself to be a little unusual. I think it's your poetic temperament. I would hardly call you devout, though I have found you meditating in your own way, but you don't do it in church. You must remember that most of your brothers went to the seminary. You'll be expected to act like a seminarian yourself. That's where I fear you're going to run into trouble. I knew I was going to like it, right? And of the things in Raids on the Unspeakable, my favorite by far is Rain and the Rhinoceros. And I have to take 5 minutes so that you just get some sense of Rain and the Rhinoceros. Thomas Merton weaves in 13 pages a fabric. He never starts a thread that he doesn't pick up later. It's just an artist of writing. And he keeps weaving back and forth the rhythm between rain, which is literally hitting the metal roof, if you've ever been on a farm, the metal roof of this little house, which is his hermitage, all alone out in Gethsemane Abbey, Kentucky, of the metal roof that's giving these rhythms of rain, and the rhinoceros, which is the other side of this tension in the thing, and you have to know what the rhinoceros is, or the whole thing doesn't make sense. I'm sorry, I thought I knew that. Yeah, okay. In all the cities of the world, it is the same, says UNESCO. The universal and modern man is a man in a rush, that is, a rhinoceros. One who has no time, who is a prisoner of necessity, who cannot understand that a thing might perhaps be without usefulness. Nor does he understand that at bottom it is the useful that may be a useless and backbreaking burden. If one does not understand the usefulness of the useless and the uselessness of the useful, one cannot understand art. And a country where art is not understood is a country of slaves and robots. Rhinoceros is this frantic human race in a rush as over against this rain that continues to come without any engineer's design to its rhythms. And in the midst of that, let me just share two or three paragraphs. Let me say this before rain becomes a utility that they can plan and distribute for money. By they, I mean the people who cannot understand that rain is a festival, who do not appreciate its gratuity, who think that what has no price has no value, that what cannot be sold is not real, so that the only way to make something actual is to place it on the market, the time will come when they will sell you even your rain. At the moment, it is still free, and I am in it. I celebrate its gratuity and its meaninglessness. The rain I am in fills the woods with an immense and confused sound. It covers the flat roof of the cabin and its porch with insistent and controlled rhythms. And I listen because it reminds me again and again that the whole world runs by rhythms I have not yet learned to recognize. I came up here from the monastery last night, sloshing through the cornfield, said Vespers, put oatmeal on the Coleman stove for supper. It boiled over while I was listening to the rain and toasting a piece of bread on a log fire. The night became very dark. The rain surrounded the whole cabin with its enormous virginal myth, a whole world of meaning, of secrecy, of silence, of rumor. Think of it. All that speech pouring down, selling nothing, judging nobody, drenching the thick mulch of dead leaves, soaking the trees, filling the gullies and crannies of the wood with water, washing out the places where men have stripped the hillside. What a thing it is to sit absolutely alone in the forest at night, cherished by this wonderful, unintelligible, perfectly innocent speech, the most comforting speech in the world, the talk that rain makes by itself all over the ridges, and the talk of the water courses everywhere in the hollows. Nobody started it. Nobody's going to stop it. It'll talk as long as it wants, this rain, and as long as it talks, I'm going to listen. That's the way the essay starts. Then he weaves lots of things. He weaves his Coleman stove, that it says on the box that it extends your hours of fun. And he says, why if you if you're out in the woods, you have to be doing something. And so in a culture of rhinoceroses, if you're not having anything else, you're having fun. You can't I just be, he says. Let me see if I can find that. It's the Coleman box, which I was supposed to shellac and which I guiltily threw outside into the woodshed, said it stretches days to give more hours of fun. Can't I just be in the woods without any special reason? Just being in the woods at night in the cabin is something too excellent to be justified or explained. It just is. There are always a few people who are in the woods at night in the rain. If there were not, the world would have ended. If you are the kind who now says, now just a minute, if there was one night where no one was in the woods, the world would not have ended. You will not enjoy Thomas Merton's essay. He brings in Philoxenes, a 6th century Syrian monk, and he reads Philoxenes by the light of his Coleman light. Then he says that there really was a place for the desert. Because at the desert, you no longer were a rhinoceros, and you found the desert which was within you. You found that your own alien self, and there was a kind of refreshment to that. But the trouble is, he says, the problem today is there are no deserts. There are only dude ranches. I once announced to the board at Holden that I was not sure if Thomas Merton came to Holden how we would come out on the spectrum of desert to dude ranch. I at least think Thomas Merton would be told by the registration to go up the hill to the dining hall and pass the bulletin board under the bell, and he would take one look and say, my God, you have people here for a week who could really move out and be alone and could discover solitude, and you entertain them. Look at that board, and they're going to do that in just 7 days. There are only 24 hours to a day. And Thomas Merton would add, which he once wrote, a monastery is consciously, deliberately boring. Oh, yes. That's a decision to have a place that's boring. The board feared, I think, at least I heard a rumor, that I was about to tell the registration that they would meet the next bus and say, welcome to Holden. We hope you can stay the full 7 days. And if there's anything you need, please tell us when you leave 7 days from now. And we hope you enjoy the solitude. And obviously, it didn't happen. The bulletin board is as tight as ever. Let me give you the last part of this. The rain has stopped. The afternoon sun slants through the pine trees. Oh, how those useless needles smell in clear air. A dandelion long out of season has pushed itself into bloom between the smashed leaves of last summer's daylilies. The valley resounds with the totally uninformative talk of creeks and wild water. The quails begin their sweet whistling in the wet bushes, and their noise is absolutely useless. So is the delight I take in it. There is nothing I would rather hear, not because it's better noise than other noises, but because it is the voice of the present moment, the present festival. Yet, even here, the earth shakes, and over at Fort Knox, the rhinoceros is having fun. Thomas Merton, contemplative monk. I think the two major contributions that Merton makes are to give us some new understanding of monk. It is not one who retreats from the world. It is one who stands in contradiction to the prevailing values of the world around. It is one who understands, let me give you Merton's own words so that I'm not putting them in my own words, who understands that there is a difference between denouncing something and renouncing something. There is a difference between not giving thanks for God, who is a giver of every good and perfect gift, and somehow saying you're better off if you just don't have anything, and so you denounce the things of the world. That's not what Merton said. Merton would say you cannot understand them as gift unless you stop hugging them so tightly to yourself and thinking that you own them. There's a big difference. We cannot see things in perspective until we cease to hug them to our own bosom. When we let go of them, we begin to appreciate them as they really are, and only then can we begin to see God in them and to live a life of thanks. There's a difference between someone who just says no to the world and then somehow tries to shelter themselves from reality, and Merton, who said what he left when he left New York was a culture in which manufactured needs were answered by manufactured goods. And for Merton, it would not be that when you came to Holden or to Gethsemane Abbey that you were leaving the real world. Merton would say, what do you mean? What's real? Is buckskin and railroad creek and trees and deer and bear and marmots? That's not real. And plastic, mafiosa modern, Muzak, Wenatchee Mall, that's real? Nothing against Wenatchee. It's just, which is the real world? And I think Merton would say that a monk is one who has become contemplative, meaning disillusioned, and therefore lives a life without the illusions that keep us from reality. It's not a retreat from that. It's saying, until you see with the eyes of faith, until you see with the eyes of the gospel, you are really not seeing reality. For Merton, the last thing Christian faith is a running from reality. And I think that's the major contribution. Let me give you one place where I think that's substantiated in, I'll have to get the page number, 72. In one word, the only way in which I can make sense in the unparalleled confusion and absurdity of the breakdown of Western culture is to recognize myself as part of a society, both sentenced and redeemed. A society which, if it can accept sentence and redemption, will live. But a society which has received the mercy of Christ and then been unfaithful to him. If my society cannot face this truth, it surely will destroy itself and perhaps everyone else besides. Let me be clear about the word breakdown. It's bound to be taken as an incomprehensible affront by those who are firmly convinced that the technological power of our society represents the highest development of man, the beginning of the golden age of plenty and of perfect freedom. I'm as ready as the next man to admire the astonishing achievements of technology. Taken by themselves, they are magnificent. But taken in the context of unbalance with the other aspects of human existence in the world, the very splendor and rapidity of technological development is a factor of disintegration. The Greeks believed that when a man had too much power for his own good, the gods ruined him by helping him increase his power at the expense of wisdom, prudence, temperance, and humanity, until it led automatically to his own destruction. One more quote and we'll quit. The Greeks were not as smart as we are. In their primitive way, they put Tantalus in hell. Madison Avenue would convince us Tantalus is in heaven. Go in peace.